Fearing a backlash, according to our next guest, the military has routinely distorted its casualty numbers in order to hide the true cost of war. His book, When Soldiers Fall, takes a new look at the way Americans have dealt with the toll of armed conflict. Drawing on a vast array of sources, from George Patton's command papers to previously untapped New York Times archives, historian Stephen Casey ranges from World War I to the War on Terror, examining official policy, the press, and the public reaction. Casey says leaders from Douglas MacArthur to Donald Rumsfeld have played down casualties, but the reverse has sometimes been true. At a crucial moment in World War II, the military actually exaggerated casualties to counter the public's complacency about the ultimate victory. Casey discusses the impact of changing presidential administrations, the role of technology, the dispersal of correspondence to cover multiple conflicts, and the enormous improvements in our ability to identify bodies. Stephen Casey is professor of international history at the London School of Economics. He joins us via phone from the UK, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. A delight to have you with us. What got you thinking about this, about casualty numbers and combat losses?
Well, it was, I suppose, the good starting place for any historian is really just being driven by the sources and what the sources were telling me. I've long been interested in the way in which American society deals with war. This is my third major book dealing with that issue. I've written previously on World War II and the Korean War, and I've therefore come across the enormous debates there have been about casualties in both of those wars. And then as I started to extend my research back to the First World War and forward to the Vietnam War, I found some very interesting parallels there. And it really sort of touched upon both the major political science debate, which revolves around this notion that as casualties increase, popular support for war declines, and the fact that really in contemporary America, that's become almost something of accepted conventional wisdom. In 2003, for instance, the press were dominated by opinion polls trying to work out the American public's sensitivity to losses. At what level of loss would they tolerate? So this has become a major issue in modern America. And I found that when I delved back into the past, there was an untold history just waiting to be told that was out there as well.
You point out in the book that it was really World War I when the U.S. government first began to report casualty numbers. Did the politicalization of those numbers and of what was happening become immediate, or did it take a while?
It was very immediate, actually. There's one of the major constants. So I think we're very used to thinking that modern Washington is polarized by partisanship, and this is something new, but actually, one of the constants throughout the book is the importance of partisanship during wartime, that politics has never really stopped at the water's edge, that wars have always been controversial inside the United States, and that both political parties have often vied with each other over both what the war is about, but also then the human toll of the war. And in the First World War, you very much had this, that the Republican Party did launch a very intensive attack on the Wilson administration and its veracity of announcing casualty figures. And that was partly due to, I think, another constant, which is the War Department as it was then, or the Defense Department as it has become. Whenever that's been headed by a particularly partisan figure, and in the First World War in 1917, it was Newton Baker, known most famously before becoming Secretary of War for being a pacifist. He was something of a target for the Republicans of the day, just as Don Rumsfeld became a target for the Democrats after 2003. And when you have a very partisan, polarizing figure in charge of the department releasing the casualty figures, that gives the opposition party a real obvious target to start questioning the veracity of what is coming out of that department.
Right, because if they're lying about that, what else are they lying about?
Exactly. Well, that's another constant as well, which is, I think, one of the... So there are a number of ways in which an administration can try and take the heat out of this issue. One is, and Franklin Roosevelt has often led the way, one is to try and make the leadership of the military, the civilian military positions in Washington, bipartisan. So Franklin Roosevelt in 1940, as the international crisis was deepening, brought in Henry Stimson and Frank Knox as the War and Navy Secretaries, and helped bipartisan make the war a more bipartisan effort, just as George W. Bush did in 2006, and Obama continued. And that does help take some of the sting out of the whole issue. The other major thing an administration can do is to only go to war with great caution and great prudence, and only go to war after there is a clear reason for going to war. So again, Franklin Roosevelt only took America to war after Pearl Harbor. Why were these casualties being sustained in the Second World War? They were being sustained because America had been attacked and America needed to destroy the country that had attacked it. When the reason for war has been far less clear and contested, Vietnam would be a great example, 1964-65, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, and again in 2003 with weapons of mass destruction, when there is almost immediately an element of distrust out there in the public discourse, which those partisans who want to try and question the cause of the war and question the veracity of government casualty figures can start picking up on.
When I use the word lie before, do you believe that it is indeed a lie, meaning that there is a malice and that it is a number that is legitimately being distorted? Because you also talk in the book that the term casualty itself it often is defined differently.
Yeah, I think that's an important element of the book, which I would like to really emphasize here. I call it the clash really between the political and the politicization of casualty figures, which happens on both sides of the aisle. You have an administration sometimes using casualties as part of their propaganda campaign, and then the political opposition challenging that. And so casualties have become deeply politicized in many of America's wars. So there's definitely a political element there, an element on occasion of political distortion. But at the same time, and perhaps in some respects a more important theme of the book and of the historical record, I think, is very much the practical problems surrounding both, on the one hand, working out who's died on the battlefield, what the casualties are, and as you point out as well, the term casualty itself is ambivalent, or it can be made ambivalent in the public discourse. So there are very real practical problems of ascertaining casualty totals at any moment in time. It's difficult anyway under the conditions of combat. When America has, and it's happened quite rarely, but when America has suffered big defeats, for instance, the Battle of the Bulge initially was a big defeat in December 1944, or when China intervenes in the Korean War in November, December 1950, the enemy tends to control the battlefield for that period of time. It's very difficult to work out who's been wounded, who's missing, and who's killed, and so there's a time lag there. By the same token, at periods of stunning military success, it's very difficult sometimes to ascertain true casualty figures. George Patton's Third Army in the August 1944 doesn't produce a single casualty figure throughout the month of August because it's too busy dashing across France to try and liberate Paris. So there is inherently a time lag there, and so official figures lag behind the reality of the battlefield, and that creates, that practical difficulty creates an opening for partisans on the other side to start accusing the government of covering up. And I think that was very much the dynamic in World War One. That was the initial concern, that there were lots of rumors, there were lots of communities that were suffering large losses. These didn't seem to be reflected in the figures that the War Department was releasing. And it was that that started to create the initial Republican attempt to politicize this whole issue. And so I think that's very much an important ingredient of the record and an important ingredient of the book. At the same time, as you point out, the phrase casualty itself is ambiguous. It encompasses missing in action, wounded in action, and killed in action. But administrations have been concerned from time to time that the public has confused casualty with fatality. The Truman administration in 1952 engaged in an intensive effort to try and to educate the American public that most casualties were going to return home with fairly light wounds, that these weren't all people killed in war. So there is that element of the whole problem as well. And at the same time, it's never been entirely clear how severe, for instance, a wound should be before they're included in the casualty figures.
Mm.
Is it only physical wounds? What about psychological wounds? Should they be included? So there is an element of ambiguity in the whole term casualty, which again creates an opening for those who question the war or those who question the administration to latch onto. And that's been interaction between the practical difficulties of handling this very sensitive, tragic and heart-rending consequence of war and the possibility of politicising casualties, that's been a constant theme throughout the past 100 or so years, definitely.
Stephen Casey is Professor of International History at the London School of Economics. His new book is When Soldiers Fall, How Americans Have Confronted Combat Losses from World War I to Afghanistan. So looking at the subtitle of How Americans Have Confronted Combat Losses, what is our threshold? When we talk about these numbers and realizing that every human life is sacred and important, when do they start to make a public difference and a political difference? In the sense, is there a tipping point where, okay, this is the cost of war to this is excessive and we have to get the hell out of there?
I think the simple answer to that is that there is no simple answer, particularly if you look back over the past 100 years. I think a couple of things, or a couple of perhaps generalizations you might be able to make there. One is that wars have been different. There was a major difference between the Second World War, when the United States was attacked at Pearl Harbor, and many Americans did view, by 1941-42, the war to be an existential threat both to the United States and democracy. And so there was, I think, because of the way in which the war unfolded to begin with and the stakes involved in a total war, there was therefore, I think, from the outset, a far greater acceptance, a willingness to accept higher casualties. That said, Franklin Roosevelt, which is another theme of the book, Franklin Roosevelt was always, like a number of other political leaders, always aware that perhaps there might be a tipping point, and so he did devise strategies to try and minimize American casualties. One of the themes of the book is so-called techno-war, trying to use American technological prowess rather than boys on the ground in order to defeat the enemy. But I think the bottom line in World War II is that in 1944-1945, as the United States is marching against both Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, and casualty figures are rising at alarming rates, there is never really any sense that the war should be brought to an end in some fashion short of unconditional surrender. So casualties don't come back and undermine domestic support. Even at the time of, for instance, in May, June 1945, the time of the big, bitter, bloody battles against the Japanese, there is still a strong determination amongst American society as a whole to see this war through to the bitter end. It's changed subsequently, partly because, of course, the wars that America has waged subsequently have been lesser order wars. Both Korea and Vietnam were limited wars, and Iraq as well was a war where American security itself wasn't directly threatened. And so I think the threshold there, I think, and the type of war that was waged immediately makes that a different calculation. And at the same time, the final point I would add here is that I think American society, or at least the American polity, if you include both the media and, say, Congress, has become more casualty sensitive over time. I think the way in which, for instance, the media has dealt with casualties has changed with the growth of 24-hour cable news networks, for instance. But also, as well, I think there's been a growing tendency, really from the midpoint of the Vietnam War, to personalize casualties. In 1969, at the time of the Battle of Hamburger Hill, Life magazine runs a special issue with biographies of the people killed in Vietnam that particular week. That was viewed at the time widely as a major turning point, personalizing and giving the backstory to these individual casualties. That was widely seen as a major difference from the past. That way of dealing with casualties on the media's part has become part of the normal course of events, and it was very much part of the normal way in which the media covered the war in Iraq. So these tragic individual stories have become, I think, more important, and although casualty figures have generally declined since the high points of the Second World War, American society at the same time has become far more sensitive to these losses.
Mm.
So, and I think now, particularly in the wake of both the Vietnam War and the war in Iraq, I think that threshold of acceptance, as we saw in Syria last year, and the deep reluctance to use force there, that threshold has become, I think, quite low. Whether that will change in the future is open to question, but I think at this moment in time, that threshold of acceptance of casualties is, I think, very low indeed.
And you make this point, but I think it's certainly worth noting. I mean, it's much different in talking about the media. It's much different to just say a number than it is to have an image such as that is on the front cover of your book of a flag-draped coffin.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and I think presidents as well have played a role in that. The nature of presidential leadership when it comes to casualties has, I argue, changed. I think one of the developing roles of the presidency in wartime has become mourner-in-chief as well as commander-in-chief. Now, this is something I think that is different. People, presidents like Wilson, Roosevelt, and Truman didn't publicly embrace this issue in the same way. Presidents sort of pre-Vietnam, pre-Lyndon Johnson, would talk about the need to make sacrifices in order to achieve victory.
Right.
But they wouldn't, for instance, tour hospitals. When Harry Truman tours a hospital in the summer of 1950, he does so without letting the press anywhere near. He does this as a very much a private episode. Now, that's changed over time. I think presidents have become empathized a lot more with the victims. They attend funerals. They very publicly attend the returning home of coffins. And presidents who, since really the 1960s, have tried to buck the trend, have faced intense media and political opposition. George W. Bush is the obvious example of that. Bush did meet with relatives privately, but he tried to conduct that side of his presidential role in private. And he was really hammered in about 2004, 2003 for so doing. It has become the expectation that presidents are going to take this on very much as a public role. And Obama, therefore, being at Dover Air Force Base in October 2009 and watching the tragic returning of the coffins has become part of the sort of media event and part of the presidential role over recent years and decades.
We only have a few moments left, but I do want to take advantage of both your accent and your title as Professor of International History.
Yeah.
How do we compare, how do Americans in the way that we confront combat losses compare with other large nations and in their military operations?
Well, I think in some respects, and perhaps I'm very much a political historian, so perhaps my first instinct here is to treat this very much as an issue of sort of political history. I think the one thing that always strikes me as a foreign observer of the United States, and it is a big difference from Britain where I live and teach, is that, of course, America is a far more open society. And the fact that you have a constitution setting up a system of separated powers does create this Congress out there. And if you go back to the start of my book, 1918, you have congressional hearings where the Secretary of War is hauled up to try and justify the casualty figures that this department is revealing each week. You have a media protected under the First Amendment, which is desperate and determined often to find out the human toll of battles and isn't going to be censored or censored very easily. And those, I think, are very noticeable different characteristics from Britain, where in the Second World War is a good example. It was a lot easier for the Churchill government just to simply clamp down on the media. And Churchill ran a coalition government. There wasn't really any parliamentary opposition. So those two things were noticeable by their absence. So I think that is one of the key elements in terms of the national political debate that I see as a major difference between the United States and say, other similar democracies, which aren't as open and don't have the same avenues for opposition to be vocalized, even in wartime.
It is a fascinating book. It is entitled When Soldiers Fall, How Americans Have Confronted Combat Losses from World War I to Afghanistan. The book is published by Oxford University Press. Stephen Casey, a delight to have you with us. Thank you very much for joining us live, and I appreciate the time that you've spent.
Many thanks indeed, Joe. Many thanks.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, When Soldiers Fall, How Americans Have Confronted Combat Losses from World War I to Afghanistan, published by Oxford. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.